Good evening, my fellow Americans. Tonight I want to talk to you on a subject of deep concern to all Americans and to many people in all parts of the world, the war in Vietnam.
Nixon told some of his aides, "I want them to believe that I'll do anything to win the war. I'll do anything to make Ho Chi Minh come to the negotiation table."
I believe that one of the reasons for the deep division about Vietnam is that many Americans have lost confidence in what their government has told them about our policy.
And therefore, sitting by the poolside one night in Florida, he came up with this rather crazy idea. Maybe we can convince them that I'm crazy. Kissinger can tell them this guy's going to do anything. How do we reinforce that? We reinforce that view. We add a little bit of credibility to that view by taking nuclear weapons and putting them on B-52s, by taking some of those B-52s and flying them close to the Soviet Union so the Soviets would know that we mean business.
The American people cannot and should not be asked to support a policy which involves the overriding issues of war and peace unless they know the truth about that policy.
Most dramatically, at the end of the month, a number of B-52s were placed on an airborne alert mission. That is, nuclear weapons were placed on those B-52s. They were sent north over Alaska to circle outside the Soviet Union's airspace in what was called Operation Giant Lance, an airborne alert to frighten the Soviet leaders and to think the United States was getting ready for a nuclear attack.
I'm Tom Morton. Welcome to Hindsight and the third episode of Torn Curtain, the secret history of the Cold War. Today, a behind-the-scenes view of the Vietnam War from both sides of the Iron Curtain. It's 1969. Richard Nixon has just been elected on a promise of peace with honour, a promise to get American troops out of Vietnam and heal the deep divisions in American society.
A teenager held up a sign, "Bring us together." And that will be the great objective of this administration at the outset, to bring the American people together.
Richard Nixon had won the presidential election of 1968 by straddling left and right, convincing anti-war Democrat voters that he was serious about getting the American troops out of Vietnam, and reassuring the Republican right that he'd do so in such a way that wouldn't sacrifice American credibility. But within 6 months of moving into the White House, Nixon would embark on a highly secret strategy of massively escalating the war and bluffing the Soviet Union that he was prepared to use nuclear weapons. The story of Richard Nixon's secret nuclear alert has remained hidden for more than 30 years.
That's one of the most interesting things. This story only comes out in the 2002, 2003, 2004 declassification process. So for many, many years, there had been hints that maybe the United States had taken some of these dangerous military operations. And yet Nixon and Kissinger and others never acknowledged them.
Professor Scott Sagan of the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. And later in the program, we'll hear some surprising and perhaps heretical revelations about how Soviet leaders saw the Vietnam War. To understand how Richard Nixon moved in the space of a few months from promising peace with honour to playing nuclear poker with the Soviets, we need to go back to Christmas Day of 1968.
Well, Kissinger asked Harry Rowan, the president of RAND, for a paper that would lay out alternative options for Vietnam, giving costs and prospects. Harry and I flew to New York to see Kissinger in the Hotel Pierre on Christmas Day, in fact, in 1968, to go over this options paper with him, which I had certainly been in charge of pulling together. A number of people at RAND worked on various options, and I coordinated it. Now, someone had mentioned the possibility of including an option for threatening or using nuclear weapons. And I had said at RAND very firmly, I would not be associated with any such effort that included such an option for Vietnam, and I would strongly object to RAND being associated with it in any way.
Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg is best known today as the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the American press, unleashing the Watergate scandal. But in the early months of the Nixon presidency, Ellsberg was still on the inside. Few people had more experience of the corridors of power in Washington, or indeed knew more about what was actually happening on the ground in Vietnam. Ellsberg had spent 2 years in Vietnam in the mid-60s, working for the State Department, much of it close to the front line, as what he himself described as a professional counter-revolutionary. On his return to Washington, Ellsberg worked for Secretary of State Robert McNamara on a top-secret study of US decision-making in Vietnam. That was what subsequently became known as the Pentagon Papers. But in late 1968, Ellsberg had been called in to chart the course ahead in Vietnam for the new president, Richard Nixon, and his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger.
When I did go over the options with Kissinger and my old friend and mentor Tom Schelling, who was a friend of Kissinger's, Kissinger brought him in at the Pierre to go over the options paper with me. And in the course of that, Schelling mentioned that he thought that I should have included a win option. It seems to me you should tell the president, the new president, if you want to win, here is how you do it. And my answer to that was, well, I don't believe there is a win option. I said, this was now, remember, the end of 1968, I said, there is no way to win for us in Vietnam. I said, you could bring in 500,000 troops, more, go up to 1 million, and things would be very quiet, as long as they stayed, and then would revert to communist control when they left. Or, I said, you could use nuclear weapons and kill all the people. I wouldn't regard that as a win. What I learned later was that Kissinger's and Nixon's secret strategy, which did exist, the secret plan, did in fact hinge on threats. That was the key to it. And specifically, threats of nuclear weapons. In other words, I don't know to this day that Kissinger believed that using nuclear weapons would be a good thing to do or a successful thing to do, but that his boss, Nixon, very much believed, and Kissinger definitely went along with it, that the threat of nuclear weapons should be very effective. And that's what Haldeman later revealed as the madman theory.
Richard Nixon believed that the road to peace in Vietnam led through Moscow. America's relationship with the Soviet Union had thawed since the Cuba crisis of the early 60s. Cold War confrontation had given way to détente and diplomacy, and Nixon believed that he could use this shift to his advantage. Here's Professor Jeffrey Kimball, author of The Vietnam War Files, Uncovering the Secret History of Nixon-Era Strategy.
What diplomacy meant privately was that he thought he could lever the Soviet Union through the use of carrots and sticks and linkage in such a way that the Soviets would then be able to pressure, cajole the North Vietnamese into making the requisite concessions in the Paris negotiations. Nixon believed that the Soviets wanted more trade, they wanted better relations with the United States, they wanted arms control agreements. So he was going to offer those carrots to them. In terms of sticks, what Nixon had in mind was that, number one, he was going to suggest to the Soviets that if they didn't cooperate in assisting the United States, he might have to turn hard, turn to the right, escalate militarily in Vietnam. He knew that the Soviets didn't want this.
Halpern, who was, as I say, Kissinger's deputy at that point, at the time he was talking to me, had seen, actually, a briefing paper for Kissinger talking to Dobrynin, the ambassador from Russia, Soviet Union, in May of 1969, and that made very grave threats, saying that the gravest consequences would ensue if they did not meet Nixon's terms, which did include mutual withdrawal of troops, American and North Vietnamese. Now, I was sure that would not work, given that they were not willing simply to accept the mutual withdrawal. It didn't seem impossible that, and I think in retrospect, they would have done well to accept the mutual withdrawal, but they had been fighting at that point for 24 years and had shown a willingness to take enormous casualties, both in direct combat and in the last 3 years of bombing, without making any major concessions at all. It was clear, as I say, by May and June that they were not going to accept it. And if that was not in their negotiating position, as seemed clear, then I felt they could stand up to whatever threats we threw at them.
Nixon and Henry Kissinger especially, they wanted the Soviets to play a more active role, to put pressure on the Vietnamese to agree on peace on American terms. That was what the Soviets did not want and could not actually do. So these cautious attitude created an impression at the White House or in Washington in general that the Soviets did not want to be actively involved in the process of negotiations.
Ilya Gaiduk from the Institute of World History at the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow. Ilya Gaiduk has been working in the former Soviet archives for over a decade now. He was the first Russian researcher to be given access to material on the war in Vietnam, which was previously considered much too sensitive. What Gaiduk has found in the archives reveals that there was a fatal flaw in the Nixon-Kissinger strategy. Far from being an obedient servant of Moscow, the North Vietnamese regime stubbornly resisted pressure from the Soviets to come to terms with Washington.
Hanoi rejected any advice or any attempt by the Soviets to influence its position, because they usually put forward an argument that, we are waging the war with against the United States, and we know the situation in our country and in this war better, so you should help us, you should send us arms and missiles and rockets and planes and train our soldiers. But please do not advise us how to wage this war, because we know better, in other words.
By mid-1969, Nixon's chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, was writing in his diary that the president was, quote, deeply discouraged that his Vietnam plans aren't working out right, unquote. At the very same time, American B-52 bombers were pounding Cambodia and Laos with high explosives. The bombings were kept secret from Congress and from the American public. But Nixon and Kissinger believed they'd send a message to Hanoi that they were prepared to escalate the war even further. However, neither the secret bombings nor secret diplomacy with Moscow were having the desired effect. It was time to raise the stakes yet again.
By July, it became clear to Nixon and Kissinger that their relationship with the Soviets was not working, that the Soviets either could not or would not cooperate to the extent that Nixon and Kissinger wanted.
Well, Richard Nixon faced a very serious problem in the fall of 1969. He wanted to figure out some way of getting the North Vietnamese to accept peace in Vietnam on his terms, that is, to let the South survive as a political entity, to accept that the United States could withdraw over time and the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong would not overrun South Vietnam.
They then decided that they would move toward the escalation option, and that consisted of first issuing threats to the North Vietnamese, indicating that Nixon was about to move drastically toward the use of enormous force against them. And they hoped that this alone would perhaps move the Soviets and the North Vietnamese to make concessions at the table. But in the end, Nixon felt he might have to actually follow through with these threats. And the operation that they were planning was codenamed in the White House Duck Hook, and consisted of bombing and mining operations in the far north of Vietnam, that is, north of the 20th parallel, in and around Hanoi, as well as along the Chinese border and along the coast. And apparently, there was some talk of the use of a nuclear device, as Kissinger referred to it, but apparently that was scratched. So the intent was sort of to ratchet up the threats, ratchet up military pressure with Operation Duck Hook.
He considered escalation of different sorts, but the American public was very tired of the war already. And there were protests planned, the moratoriums planned in Washington and New York.
Downtown on Michigan and Balboa Avenues, the protesters, Dellinger, Hayden, Davis, Rubin, Hoffman.
But especially he was worried about two or three, actually, demonstrations that the anti-war movement was planning for mid-October and mid-November.
Peace now. Dump the hump.
Keep the bayonets high was the order. About face.
Stop the war.
What Nixon feared was that the demonstration, especially the November one, would morph into a larger demonstration against the bombing had Duck Hook been launched.
Police, the National Guard, the tear gas, the counter-drama between the rostrum and the paddy wagon.
Guys can move ahead, pushing ahead. The demonstrators move back.
By the autumn of 1969, anti-war protests across America were reaching a crescendo. Many Americans had been deeply shocked by images of the war broadcast on primetime television. Images of what the CBS News anchorman Walter Cronkite described as a burned and blasted and weary land. The war touched all aspects of American culture. While the protesters on the street chanted "Blowing in the Wind," composer George Crumb was working on his string quartet, Black Angels, a cry of anguish for Vietnam. Given the growing opposition to the war, Nixon knew that whatever he did now would have to be invisible to the American public. Scott Sagan.
And Nixon was concerned that if he launched a large-scale conventional military attack on North Vietnam to try to coerce them to the negotiation table, that would backfire and that his domestic political standing would fall. Indeed, he was concerned that even his Secretary of State might resign if that occurred. So he came up with this other plan. He looked back at the Eisenhower administration and believed, quite inaccurately, by most historians' views, he believed that Dwight Eisenhower had successfully ended the Korean War by threatening to use nuclear weapons against China. He thought he could do the same kind of thing.
Nixon also had been taught at the knee of Dwight Eisenhower, who was a big believer in the theory of unpredictability, the uncertainty principle, to communicate to the other side that one might be capable of irrational action.
He wanted to create a sense of danger and risk. He didn't have a game plan that said, if the Russians do this, I will do this. If the Russians take this next step, I will do this step. Instead, he wanted to have a sense, at least convey to the Russians, that regardless of what happens, I'm willing to go all the way. The gambler who is willing to really stake everything, Nixon believed, would be a better gambler, might actually convince the Russians to back down. You don't want to take a step-by-step approach. You want to really show that you're willing to do anything.
Now, what was different from, let's say, the Johnson administration was that the Johnson administration, for the most part, even though having used enormous power in Vietnam, had, for example, in the case of bombing the North, had applied this power incrementally, had escalated incrementally. The Johnson strategy was more akin to the turning of the screw as in a medieval torture chamber. What Nixon had in mind was escalation more rapidly, more brutally, more ferociously, as Kissinger put it once.
It was a secret nuclear alert, which is sounds like a contradiction in terms. You can't have a secret crisis, obviously. But what we were trying to do was to convince the Russians that Nixon was crazy enough that he might use nuclear weapons over Vietnam, what he called the madman theory.
I was saying to him that in the 50s, I was responsible for what we call the Eisenhower policy. Then the policy of...
Well, we now have some hard evidence of Richard Nixon's belief in the madman theory straight from the horse's mouth. From early in 1971, Nixon began recording every word that was spoken in his office. Thousands of hours of his conversations with his top aides, such as Henry Kissinger, were stored on tape. And after a series of protracted legal battles by public interest groups in the United States, those tapes have now been made public. What you're about to hear is a recording of Nixon talking to Henry Brandon in February 1971. Because the sound quality is so bad, we've used an actor's voice to make it easier to hear. But the words you'll hear are those of Nixon himself, waxing lyrical on the value of nuclear threats.
But in the 50s, I was a strong supporter of what we call the Eisenhower-Dulles policy. It was derided as brinkmanship, as it was derided also as a massive retaliation and the rest, but it was a viable policy.
When the United States had an enormous nuclear advantage,
the United States had enormous nuclear advantage, the United States could say to the world, if in any place in the world one of our allies or countries whose interest is similar to ours is attacked, we will consider the use, and might very well use, our nuclear superiority to deter that attack or to answer it. Europe can rely on it. John Kennedy could, the Cuban Missile Crisis, even though it was what they felt at the time, even though they felt there was a danger of nuclear war, well, I don't know why. The danger really was only great if there was a madman or a completely unrealistic leader in the Kremlin, and there was no madman there, and certainly, and the one thing we can say for our communist friends, They're enormously pragmatic and sober.
As you heard, Richard Nixon believed that the Soviet leaders were enormously pragmatic and sober. But the essence of the madman theory was to convince them that he was not.
How would you try to convince them of that? Well, if you did it in a way that was public, that the American public knew about, it would actually create such a violent set of demonstrations in the United States that he would have to back down. So he told Kissinger, and Kissinger told Al Haig, who was his military assistant at the time, to get the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense to plan a set of military operations, nuclear alerts, that would be serious enough that the Russians would notice them, but not visible to the American public. He told some of his aides, I want them to believe that I'll do anything to win the war. I'll do anything to make Ho Chi Minh come to the negotiation table. And therefore, sitting by the poolside one night in Florida, he came up with this rather crazy idea. Maybe we can convince them that I'm crazy. Kissinger can tell them this guy's going to do anything. How do we reinforce that? We reinforce that view. We add a little bit of credibility to that view by taking nuclear weapons and putting them on B-52s, by taking some of those B-52s and flying them close to the Soviet Union so the Soviets would know that we mean business.
Nixon launched a nuclear alert in order to compensate for his cancellation of Duck Hook. What he hoped about the nuclear alert, which began on October 15th, was that they might think that this was a prelude to the massive operation that he had warned he would carry off. It was a bluff.
On October 10th, 1969, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Earl Wheeler, sent a top-secret message to military commanders around the world saying that he had been asked by higher authorities to increase U.S. military readiness to respond to a possible confrontation by the Soviet Union. Under that order, the Strategic Air Command was told to get ready to stand down its air combat training missions and to increase the number of nuclear, in this case B-52 bombers and missiles, on alert. Over the next weeks, the Strategic Air Command did exactly that. Most dramatically, at the end of the month, a number of B-52s were placed on an airborne alert mission. That is, nuclear weapons were placed on those B-52s. They were sent north over Alaska to circle outside the Soviet Union's airspace in what was called Operation Giant Lance, an airborne alert to frighten the Soviet leaders and to think the United States was getting ready for a nuclear attack.
So, I mean, this was kept secret from the American public, it was kept secret from Congress, and indeed it was kept secret from some of the senior military officers who were actually carrying it out.
Well, the operation was kept secret from the public and from our allies. Indeed, we did not tell NATO allies or allies in Asia. The cause of the operation, that is, what was the purpose behind it, that was kept secret from the U.S. military. So the very senior commanders in the Pentagon knew why Nixon was doing this. But the commanders out in the field were simply told, get ready for this potential conflict and put your nuclear weapons on a higher state of alert. It created a great deal of confusion because they didn't know whether this was going to last for a long time, for a short time. They didn't know whether it was a conflict over Europe or over Vietnam. Indeed, the Secretary of Defense, Melvin Laird, thought that the madman theory was, frankly, mad, that Nixon was doing something that he thought was utterly inappropriate and potentially dangerous.